Hello and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we will be discussing the short story, The Story of Your Life, by Ted Chiang, and the film adaptation, Arrival. You're listening to the third episode of History in Reverse. My name is Caroline, and I'm here with my father, Richie.
Hi.
And today is actually Father's Day that we're recording this
That's
podcast.
Right. Very appropriate.
So, happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
Today we will be discussing The Story of Your Life, which is a short story within a collection of Ted Chiang's story, and the whole book is called The Story of Your Life, right?
Yes.
And this is the story that the movie Arrival, which came out in 2016,
yes,
was based on. It was very popular, pretty successful science fiction movie that came out. Before we jump into that, though, let me just a couple of front matter things. This is our continuation of our project to do every month or so, read something or watch something and do a podcast and discuss it. So this is the third episode, and this is the first time we'll be talking about a movie in conjunction with the story,
right,
as well, which hopefully we get to do later as well. And we do have a new icon. Our podcast has a fancy new icon, which our friend Melanie made, and it's awesome, and I love it. So
yes,
shout out to Melanie.
Thanks,
thank
Melanie.
You. It looks great. So check out our new fancy icon. So jumping into The Story of Your Life, Ted Chiang is the author. He's written quite a bit. And I know, Dad, you looked up a little bit about him.
Right, so he's a fairly young American science fiction writer. He was born in 1967. And The Story of Your Life is one of his early works. It actually won a couple of awards,
mm-hmm,
including Best Nebula, Best Novella, a Nebula Award for Best Novella.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his earliest stories that won some awards as well was a story called Tower of Babylon, which is,
mm-hmm,
also in the collection, which I think is also really nice.
Yeah, I read that one too, yeah.
Story of Life was written in 1999. I guess it was published in 1999. So it's been around for a while. And he's written a bunch of other stuff since then, but it seems like this collection of his stories is like the main one.
Mm-hmm.
There's a book that he wrote recently called The Life Cycle of Software Objects. I was interested in buying it.
Mm-hmm.
And the only available version are like in hardcover for $150 a piece.
Oh.
So seems like an odd. So I probably will.
Can wait on that for now.
Yes.
That's weird. It's not on Kindle?
No.
Everything's, how do you highlight things if it's not on Kindle? Yeah. So within this collection, I think we both saw the movie Arrival first, right?
Yes.
And then we ended up reading the story.
Right.
And I've seen the movie now, I think, three times. I think you've seen it twice.
Twice.
And then this is the second read-through for both of us for
right,
the story.
Right.
So before we jump into a summary or discussion, I guess, just off the bat, what would you think? Did you prefer the movie or the story, or do you think they're both good?
They were surprisingly both good. Usually movie adaptations are horrible.
Yeah.
And this was like probably one of the better ones that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, last time when we talked about Solaris, we talked about the movie adaptation of Solaris, which were and interesting movies, but not particularly good adaptation,
mm-hmm,
of the books. In this case, I think it worked.
Yeah, I agree. Actually, I when we saw the movie, I loved it. I was like really obsessed with it. And then I saw it a second time and realized I totally misinterpreted it the first time. Because I didn't get the main plot, really, until the second watch. So I guess we're going to discuss the story in the movie at the same time. So mostly
right,
we're
going
to
discuss... Right, there's going to be lots of spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie or read the book...
Then
and...
stop and go see the movie.
Right.
It's like, what, 2 hours? Like, go watch it and come back.
Right.
So I think we're going to be describing the plot of the book, and then as it... Because the movie does really follow it very closely.
Right.
So where there are differences, we'll bring them up and discuss them as they occur. And we're going to try to describe this plot as linearly as possible. So why don't you start with the beginning? Where does the story start?
Well, I suppose the story starts with the arrival of the aliens,
mm-hmm,
right? Which is why the movie is called Arrival. But what I wanted to say is that this is like really two stories in one, where they kind of interweave, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's the story of basically how to communicate with the aliens that arrive,
mm-hmm,
on Earth. And the main character, which is a woman,
mm-hmm,
for a change,
yes,
is a linguist. And she's asked to translate the language of the aliens and she insists that she has to meet them and talk to them in order to be able to understand the language. The book basically is that. It's like what happens when you try to understand this language and some odd things that they discover about the language and what it implies to people who will learn it, I guess. So that's so one of the two stories is the story of how they try to communicate with the aliens and how they discover things about the language and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The other story is about her daughter. And so this woman has a daughter. She talks about her being a baby and growing up and being older. And ultimately, the daughter dies. Mm-hmm. And there's some differences here between the story and the movie.
Mm-hmm. So at the time when the aliens arrive, though, does she have a daughter?
Well, good question. So if you read the story or you read the you see the movie, you can't tell, right? Mm-hmm. When I first saw the movie, the first couple of shots are of a daughter playing, you assume that she's remembering something that happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And only later you realize that it's not exactly correct.
Right. So the main character's name is Louise, and she's, like you said, she's a linguist. And I think what's sort of interesting about this story that's different from maybe some of the other science fiction we were reading was that this is like, this could happen in like modern day Earth.
Right.
Like none of the technology that the humans are using is really science fiction technology. It's like recording with video, recording with audio, that kind of stuff. Right. Computer programs, you know, math that we currently have, that kind of thing. All the science fiction really comes from the aliens.
Right.
So in the books, the aliens arrive by sending down what they call looking glasses, which is this...
a communication device. It's like a big it's like screen. a video conferencing
system. Yeah, they're like Skyping in. It's like a big, kind of milky screen. And they send a few of them, several of them around.
Actually, in the story, they send a lot of them. There's a few hundred. Whereas in the movie, the ships actually sort of land, but there's only...
That's the difference. In the movie, it's sort of this giant, imposing... like black egg-shaped ships that sort of float above
fields. Right, which is like when I first saw the advertisements for the movie, I said, oh no, it's another one of those movies that the aliens arrive and everything blows up.
Right.
And there's a big fight, so we were pleasantly surprised when we actually watched it.
Definitely. And I think this sort of calls back to when we read, what was it, Ursula Le Guin's story, Left Hand of Darkness,
mm-hmm.
where the emissary in that story said, if you just send one person, it's a curiosity, but if you send a whole... boatload of people to the planet, it's like an invasion and it's threatening.
Right.
And in the story of your life, the people aren't particularly frightened by the looking glasses. They're curious about them.
Right.
But the presence of the ships in the movie, I think, sort of changes the tone a lot because the people in the movie are much more frightened. They feel a lot more threatened by it. And I mean, I guess understandably so because the ships are like,
huge.
Massive. So in both the story and the movie, Louise ends up going and being able to meet the aliens.
And I think she's recruited, the way the recruiting happens of hers, it's kind of similar in both,
mm-hmm.
where the military comes to her, because I guess she's a well-known linguist, and they play her a recording of some speech of the aliens, and they said, can you translate this?
Yeah.
And she just gives them a strange look, and she says, basically, I have to meet them in person, you know, mm-hmm. and talk to them. Otherwise, you can't translate the language just from listening to it.
And there's like a movie, there's more concern that like the military doesn't want information to spread or something. They don't want to, they have like they made it more dramatic.
There's a little bit of that in the story, but
not as much. So she ultimately goes and she ends up meeting the physicist.
Right, so I think in the book, it's maybe clearer, they're trying to follow like the standard way we think how we communicate with aliens.
Mm-hmm.
You would, you know, send them prime numbers or some mathematical formulas. And she's a linguist. She says, you can't talk about that stuff unless you can say, you know, hello, here I am. You know, mm-hmm. this is me, this is you.
Yeah.
You know, and that point is not made as clearly in the movie, although they do have a... They do show her, like, showing the aliens, like, the very basic things. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm Louise. Mm-hmm. This is Gary, the physicist.
Yeah.
And the physicist was there so that he could somehow present some physical laws to the aliens and mm-hmm. us to make it, like, a basis for mm-hmm. communication.
So let's talk about what the aliens look like.
So what are they called?
They're called heptapods because they have seven legs. Hepta is seven?
What is hepta? Seven or eight?
Seven.
Seven.
Eight is octo.
Okay,
so Hepta,
Hepta, yes.
Yeah. So they look similar. The description from the book is largely played out on screen, I think.
Right. So in the movie, they kind of hide them in this fog, so you yeah. can see them quite.
So the way it works is, so in the book, there's the looking glass. That's this big, it's sort of like a movie screen. Like, imagine if it was just a movie screen.
It's really very good video conferencing system.
Yeah, it really is. It's clean energy. And and then what they do in the movies, they take the same concept of the looking glass, like a movie screen, but they put it inside the giant spooky ship.
Right, because the aliens live in a different atmosphere, so they want them to, you know.
Well, that's a big difference. In the movie, they're actually in the ship on the planet.
Right.
Whereas in the book, it seemed like they're just Skyping in.
Right.
They didn't leave home. They just sent.
Well, they're in orbit of Earth.
Is there a ship in orbit?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I missed that. So they're not physically on the planet, which again I think changes the threatening level.
Right.
And yeah, there's like this in the movie. There's like this sort of like fog, and then the heptapods are like black. And they have seven long legs, kind of look like a squid kind of thing.
Squiddish, yeah.
Yeah, squiddish. But the legs are sort of stiffer, so they like walk on them.
Right.
And it's a similar description in the book. In the book, though, there's an interesting difference. The heptapods in the book have eyes.
Right.
And it's like the cone of their body, you know, goes up and tapers off. And at the top of that is eyes, or seven eyes around all sides. So that basically the heptapod has no front or back.
Right. They only just walk forward, basically.
Right. It's like they can
walk. No matter which direction they go.
Right. Yeah. And it's sort of one of the early hints as to what Luis is going to discover in terms of the language.
Right.
That there's no forward. They don't have a forward or backward. They don't have a direction.
So turns out that they have very difficult time trying to understand the spoken language of the heptapods. Mm-hmm. And it's just like impossible to decipher or reproduce or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they try to do writing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they hold up signs saying, you know, I'm Louise, or, mm-hmm. you know, this is an arm.
Mm-hmm.
And heptapods also have writing.
Mm-hmm.
So in the book, they call them heptapod A, which is the spoken language, and heptapod B, which is the written language.
Mm-hmm.
And what they discover very quickly, what do they call them? Logograms?
They call them logograms, and then she changes the name to something else later, but logogram is fine. It's something like that.
So one of the interesting things that she discovers about this written language, that unlike human languages that we know, is the writing does not represent words or sounds, it represents symbols.
Mm-hmm.
So you can think of it like if you have a little drawing of a person running across the road,
mm-hmm.
you know, that means something, but it's not the word.
Right, there's no sound with it, yeah.
Right. And so the two languages are quite different.
Mm-hmm. And the visual is similar, but I actually thought that the movie did a better job in this way because the logograms of the book is sort of like, it's still like a line of writing,
right.
But it's all sort of meshed together or whatever. It's like a sort of like a spider web kind of thing. And in the movie, they did the same thing, but they made them into circles,
right.
Which I thought was really interesting. So every heptapod's like sentence or idea was in a circle, and then the circle has like weird little squiggly lines on it and right. stuff. Which again sort of hints at the, you know, the ultimate conclusion with the language. Right.
So like a couple of things I noted is like if you think about having written language that is not tied up to words, like painting, for example, art.
Mm-hmm.
Art, you know, a painting can convey a lot of meaning without having specific words
mm-hmm.
represented by things. Mathematical notation is another one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in math you can write things that don't really have, they may have names or something, but the meaning is something beyond the, you know, it's just in the symbols, not mm-hmm. anything else.
Yeah. It's super trippy.
So I guess we can give away a little bit of... So what was this whole other story happening besides the aliens? What about her daughter?
So this sort of goes to the structure of the story, I think, and the movie mimics this, which is great. So the story is structured where more or less every other chapter goes between these two stories.
Right.
And you get like a chapter about like and the story of the heptapods basically goes chronologically.
Right.
So we have like that one chronological thread of like the heptapods arrive and then we did these various experiments and it moves forward. And then we get these cuts to the very, and the chapters are all pretty short. We get these cuts to these chapters where Luis will say something like, I remember a day when you will be yada, yada, yada. Like, I remember a day when we will be going to the mall together. And you actually pointed out the tense issue
right
there.
Right. So basically she talks about her daughter. So she talks about different points in life of her daughter, when she was born, when she, I don't know if she talks about being born in the book. Maybe she does a little bit.
She talks about when she's an infant.
She talks when she's a teenager. Mm-hmm. She talks about just various different things that mm-hmm. happened to her. But every one of those sections begins, is written in future tense, mm-hmm. which it's just kind of very subtle that I didn't notice actually on the first reading.
Yeah, I didn't notice it
on the on second reading, and not right away anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You have an example?
Yeah, I'm trying to see, because I highlighted a bunch of stuff in my Kindle for this one, especially after you told me about that, and I was like, oh man, you're right. So like this one, this is, I think, towards the end, she says, I remember when you'll be a month old, and I'll stumble out of bed to give you your 2 a.m. feeding. Your nursery will have that baby smell of diaper rash cream and talcum powder with a faint ammoniac. Yeah. I'm really good at this. Ammoniac whiff coming from the diaper pail in the corner. I'll lean over your crib, lift your squalling form out, and sit in the rocking chair to nurse you. So it's sort of this, it's future tense.
Right.
But it's her saying, I remember.
So, but the first sentence of the story, interesting enough, is in present tense.
Really?
Yes. It says, your father is about to ask me the question.
Oh. Interesting.
Okay. So that's kind of the big hint that the what seems like memories of a daughter are written in future tense, and mm-hmm. they're really meant to be happening in the future.
Right.
And I think maybe the zero-sum game is the non-zero-sum game.
That's a good example.
Kind of the giveaway.
Right. Yeah, I agree. That? Yeah, well, so basically what's happening with the structure and like I was saying before, the movie mimics this by cutting scenes together, is that we realize as the story progresses that what's happening is as Luis is learning the heptapod language, she's beginning to perceive time differently because the heptapods perceive time differently.
Right.
And language controls your reality, and we could talk a little bit more about that. But the zero-sum game moment is one of the biggest reveals in both the book and the movie, where you get a scene where Luis says something like,
So what's happening is Luis is sitting, she's at her house and her mm-hmm. daughter's doing some homework.
Mm-hmm.
And she asks, and clearly by then, you know, she had divorced her father.
Right.
Right. So mm-hmm. he's not there. But she mentioned he's a scientist.
Right.
And the daughter says, I'm writing a report and I need to know this word for this kind of a game where, you know, you don't lose. It's just that everybody wins. And, mm-hmm. and Luis says, is that a win-win game? And she says, no, that has some much more scientific sounding name.
Right.
And says, I don't know, you have to call your father to ask him that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then they cut to the scene where she's talking to the heptapod. So she's like involved in the research mm-hmm. and the, what's his name, Gary. The physicist talks about something and he says it's a non-zero-sum game.
Mm-hmm.
And then you flip back.
Right. And it goes right back into that scene. And Luis, in that scene, knows the answer as being non-zero-sum game, and so then she tells her daughter.
Right.
And so that's one of the first times we really see her passing information to herself through this, like, new understanding of time.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And they do it in the movie as well, and it works in the same way as it does in the book, right. Which is great. So I'm trying to think of, like, what actual events occur, because there's a lot of, like, discussion of math, and then I guess they make a breakthrough with the heptapods at one point with the math.
Well, as she's learning more of the written language, she's starting to slowly to realize that it's kind of, right. So this is this goes to the whole idea of how language influences your thinking
mm-hmm.
and your perception. And we actually just watched a very nice TED talk with super examples of just that. So we'll link to it in the notes.
Mm-hmm.
But the example I really like is of the Aborigines who have language that doesn't have the words for left and right.
Right.
And instead, they always describe things in terms of directions, cardinal directions, like north, south, west, east.
Mm-hmm.
And like she said in the TED Talk, she says, they'll say, look, there is an ant crawling on the southeast part of your leg.
Yeah.
Of course, if you turn the other way around, it'll be, you know, northwest or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But she says, because all these people learn this kind of stuff from when they're tiny babies, everyone there knows exactly where north, south, east are all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just like fundamental to their way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so this shows you how language influences your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea is kind of explored in the story, right? So with the heptapod writing language, is somehow time independent, and it lets you see all of time, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And they get a little bit into physics.
Yeah.
Trying to explain this. And
well, so there's a scene. There's a scene where she's working on the writing, and they didn't really. I guess they didn't really do this in the movie because they couldn't really. But she's trying to parse out from like you know a big string of like spider webby kind of loops that the heptapod writes. She's trying to parse out pieces and strokes and like see if there's like an alphabet or if there's something she can pull out of it. And she videotapes the heptapod writing. And the way they write it is like they use their tentacles to make like ink.
Yeah, actually, that was very cool in the movie.
Yeah, that was like very visual. So the she films it and she slows it down and watches the ink coming out of the heptapod tentacle and realizes that like the first stroke that it makes is a stroke that's used in like multiple parts, like multiple characters of the
right,
sentence.
Right, like you have to know the entire sentence
right
before you can start writing it.
Right, exactly. That's right. Yeah. So she's like, you know, they must know the whole sentence first, which is weird to think about like when you sit down to write something, you have an idea of kind of where you're going, but you don't know for sure like exactly what words
normal
are
people
gonna,
don't.
Yeah. Maybe Luis does, but not us. And so she starts to realize that their language does seem to be independent of time, or at least from linear time. And then you start to get all these things sort of come together, like the structure of the heptapod itself, the fact that it's, you know, perfectly symmetrical all the way around. It has no forward or backward.
Right.
Its writing doesn't, the logograms don't have to be in any particular order. The strokes don't have to be in any particular order. All these things like that. And as she's learning it, she's basically beginning to see time in the way that they must be seeing time, which is without a linear structure.
Right, kind of.
Yeah.
So then they throw in some physics into all this, because as it turns out, in physics, a lot of the formulas and stuff are not dependent on time.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of example I always use, I don't pretend to understand this, but you know, you can say that, you know, an electron moving forward is the same thing as a positron going backwards in time. And that sounds really crazy.
Yeah.
But if you write the equation, if you, you know, electron has negative charge, positron has positive charge.
Mm-hmm.
So if you change the sign of the charge from plus to minus, and you change the sign of time from plus to minus, mm-hmm. minus time minus is plus. So you get the same exact equation, but you can describe it in these two different ways.
Mm.
And neither one is wrong.
That blows my mind.
And they also talk about Fermi's principle and this variational physics.
Oh, the beam of light, yeah.
So the beam of light is just an example, but a lot of laws in physics can be stated that way, which is rather than describing how things change in time, you can say something will always take the minimum, the light always takes fastest path from one point A, point B. So light kind of has to know ahead of time what's in front of it, because when it goes through water, it has to bend the right way because speed of light is different in water. And it's...
Yeah, no, I love this. I love the Fermat's principle thing because it's a science-y thing I understood, actually, when I read it.
Okay, go ahead.
So, like you were saying, the whole idea is that light will take the fastest route to a point. And if you look at light when light comes from, say, the sun, if the point that it's going to is, like, somewhere underwater, it's, like, under a lake, when the light hits the water, it doesn't just go straight down to the point, but because water refracts light differently than air, the light bends and goes in this, like, sort of different way. So if you were to draw it out, it would be like a straight line till it hits the water, and then it like sort of bends and goes into whatever direction to the point. And that's because it's faster for the light to go that way and go through less water, because light travels slower through water. It's faster for light to go through less water than for it to go straight and go through more water than it would time-wise go slower to the point.
Right. So light has to kind of know.
It has to know what the point is, right? That's the whole thing. It has to know what the ending is before it goes to be able to, for lack of a better word, to be able to choose the path that's fastest.
Right.
And this is actually one of my favorite scenes in the book where, and when this is sort of when Luis is putting together what's happening to her, because she's experiencing this kind of thing where she's like remembering stuff, and it comes across a little bit more in the movie, I think.
Yeah.
Because she says, "Who is this child?" She's having these
right.
memories of a child she doesn't know. And in the movie, she says to her, she wakes up from a dream or something, and she says, "Who is this child?" So she's starting to figure out like the mystery of like what's happening to her. And in the book, she's sitting with Gary at a Chinese food restaurant, and she says, "I don't really get the Fermat's principle thing. It seems a little wonky to me."
Right.
And they talk about the fact that light would need to know the point it's going towards before it even begins its path in order to pick the fastest path.
Right, and that kind of links it up to how heptapods write, right?
Right, exactly.
When they start writing, it's like, you know, exactly, they can like start writing from both ends or something.
Right, exactly. So I guess the reveal, I mean, they basically do all these experiments. It's like, it's really science-y. They do various experiments to learn the heptapod's language, and they make some breakthroughs with the math. And then in the movie, there's sort of all this political tension.
Right, so in the movie, they're trying to build up tension to like some kind of a climax and to make the movie more exciting, I suppose. I think you're right. It wouldn't work otherwise. The movie would be kind of very slow, like Solaris.
Yeah. the story is fantastic, and I think the story, because of its structure, it keeps the attention because of the sort of the mystery and the like the slow reveal of how the language is working.
Right, and it's very cleverly done through writing.
Right, that I don't think you could really translate to a movie. Right. So I understand why they did that.
Right, so in the movie, basically what happens is there's all these countries that are trying to communicate with heptapods, and military being paranoid, as they always are, saying, make sure you don't reveal anything to the heptapods.
Mm-hmm.
And they're making a big deal of a translation of some word, whether it means tool or weapon.
Right.
Right. And so they're trying to ask them, why did you come here?
Right. They want to know the purpose. Right. And they say they want to know their purpose. It's all about the purpose. It's all about the goal. Yeah. So they're trying to figure out, because I think one of the heptapod screens or one of the heptapod ships in the movie tells somebody that they're there to give them a gift, and the gift is a weapon. And like they translate it as weapon.
Right.
But then Luis is like, well, hold up. You know, it could mean tool, it could mean whatever.
And then in the movie, what happens is there's all these scientists collaborating from each site where they're talking to the aliens. And the military decides that this is too dangerous and they cut it off.
Right.
And so there's this big thing where I guess the Chinese are about to go and blow up the ship attack the ship that's on there in the country. And then we have these interesting cuts. So there's like a cut to where Louise is at this party, like a United Nations or something. Mm-hmm. And she's talking to the leader of the Chinese army.
Yeah, the Chinese General Shang, I think it is. Something like that.
Oh, Chang, maybe like the guy's name.
Oh, maybe they named it after Chang. Oh, I didn't realize that. I think they might have.
You might have, yeah. And he tells her, you know, it was a good thing that you called me on my private number before we started the attack, so we stopped it and everything turned out well.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, but I never knew your private number. And he says, well, here it is. And he shows her his phone.
Yeah.
And then it cuts back to the point where this tension's building up. They're getting ready, you know, military's trying to get ready to attack or something.
Mm-hmm.
And she grabs a phone.
Yeah.
And calls the general.
Yeah.
And tells him, he told it like a secret.
Yeah.
So
his wife's dying words, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So that, you know, he would know. And that kind of convinces them to stand down.
Yeah. And so that's like, by that point, she's figured out that this what's happening with this.
Right.
And it's sort of circular in this way. I think it comes across in the movie really well. As she's learning the heptapod's language, her brain is sort of reorganizing itself to understand time differently.
Right.
And as she's understanding time differently, she's gaining knowledge from the future that's informing her now.
Right.
Which includes her complete understanding of the heptapod language. Because we see her having these flashes of future memories of like the book she wrote and her teaching the class on the heptapod language and like all the things. And so she like very suddenly goes from like having a sort of basic understanding to really having a full understanding.
Right.
Because it all sort of comes in at once.
Well, in the story, she says she never quite has full understanding, but enough that she can perceive time in this different way.
Yeah, because she says her brain is too wired to like a human's to really get it all the way, but she gets it pretty well. That's the climax, basically. What's the climax in the story?
The story comes back to the beginning of where he says, let's make a baby.
Yeah.
So Gary, the physicist, and the story actually becomes the husband and the father of a child. And, you know, and the story begins where they're clearly like at home having had some wine, some party, and say, okay, let's make a baby. Mm-hmm. And then the story ends in the same scene.
Right.
And I just, as we just noticed, the scene is written in the present tense.
Yeah.
I think what I want to talk about is the two themes, right? So one is the language affects your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So whatever language you speak, you know, you write, changes your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of interesting idea here is that the author kind of took these ideas from physics, where time, mm-hmm. What is the nature of time?
Oh, I don't know.
Right. So...
Well, so can I tell a little anecdote from our family about this?
Well, we should also talk about the story actually of the daughter. We talk about the aliens. Let's talk about the other part.
I have a thing for about language. I don't know if you remember this. So, my mother, your wife, you know her.
I do.
She was an English teacher for a really long time, 7th grade English. And one of the lessons she would do with her students in the beginning of the year was basically she'd take out colored pencils and she'd split the room in half and she'd say, okay, this side, pick two colors. You can use two colors. So everyone would pick like red and blue or something. And then the other side, she'd give them the entire box. And of course the first side would get very upset. And then she'd get everyone pictures to color. And they were only allowed to use the pencils they had access to. So the one half of the room only had all these pictures that were all, you know, colored nicely, but they only had blue and red or something. And the other side had all the beautiful colors. And she'd tape them up to the board. And the whole point was you can only execute something as well as, like, the tools that you have. And it was supposed to be a metaphor for vocabulary. Like, this is why it's important to study vocabulary. Because you can only express yourself to the extent that your language allows you to.
Right.
And so you need a big vocabulary to be able to paint a pretty picture just like the colored pencils. So... It's very relevant. That same idea is relevant here, right? It's like the whole concept that it's absolutely true. Your language does control the extent to which you can not only express yourself but understand information.
Or understand the world, right? So again, from this TED Talk, I mean, these Aborigines who know which way is north at the time.
Yeah.
All languages, like she mentioned in the same talk, that don't have counting numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to learn math if you cannot count,
mm-hmm.
right? So let's talk a little bit about the daughter, because it's a kind of sad story.
Yeah, so the it's similar between the book and the movie, but it's different. So basically, Luis, I guess chronologically what happens is Luis gets married to Gary. They have the daughter. She's not named in the book, but she's named in the movie. Her name is Hannah.
Right.
Because the name Hannah reads the same forwards and backwards.
It's the palindromes.
And Luis is a nerd, so that's what she named her daughter. And in the books... The daughter grows up, and Luis has a lot of memories of her as a little girl doing regular little girl things, and then sort of being a rebellious teenager, and seems like she sort of struggles with the parents' divorce a little bit,
right.
and stuff like that. And then the daughter gets into an accident and dies when she's 25, I think.
In the book, yes.
Yeah, in the book.
Right.
The difference in the movie is that the daughter dies same. Also dies at 25, but dies...
No, I thought she dies younger.
She looked like an adult to me. They didn't specify an age. She dies from some genetic disease that's like an incurable mystery genetic disease that kills her. But I think those have different implications in terms of this. So, you know, the fact that in the book it's an accident...
Right, I think what the author is trying to explore the idea here. So, you know, it says, if I know what the future...
Mm-hmm.
Why can't I change it?
Right? Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, having your child die is probably a pretty horrible thing to happen mm-hmm. to anyone.
Yeah.
And the question is, why doesn't she change it?
Mm-hmm.
And there's some of the stuff I have, like, some interesting things from the book. And let's see. The existence of free will meant that we couldn't know the future. And if we knew free will existed because we had a direct experience of it. So it's like what he says... Or what Luis says in the book is that, you know, just because you know the future doesn't mean you can change it. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, you just kind of play it out. And it, and some of the interesting things, I think, what she said, it, even if you know what's going to happen, mm-hmm. until you say it, it doesn't happen. Like, oh, I know what, how it came out. So heptapods speak, heptapod A, mm-hmm. which is like normal linear speech. You know,
right. They make sound, yeah.
And then they write, and the writing is completely different mm-hmm. in the sense that it's not time dependent. And what she's, I think she says in the book, it's a, for the heptapod, spoken language is like a play. If you go to Shakespeare play, you know exactly what words are coming up. Mm-hmm. But still, it's a play. Or like a wedding. You know, a wedding has a script and people say the right things, but mm-hmm. until they say it, they're not married.
Right.
Know? So,
yeah.
So I was thinking about that. You know, this idea of a play and stuff. And one idea, one analogy I thought of for the heptapod B language is music.
Yes, right? Yes. So, I like this analogy a lot. I think it's really good.
So if you think of a musical score, like for a large symphony, mm-hmm. it's all there, right? It's all written out, tells you exactly what's going to happen, mm-hmm. What the timing is and so forth. But, and somebody who reads music can look at it and can, you know, sort of hear it in their heads, mm-hmm. as but it's like a whole thing. But it still has to be played out in time. Like if you right. want to actually say it, you have to go step by step.
Mm-hmm. But you can look at it and know, like if you're able to read it,
right?
You know the feelings and the and right. the sound.
So like when you read stories about Mozart, who was like a musical genius, mm-hmm. when he had to write a composition, somebody asked him, says, "So when are you going to write the symphony?" I said, "I already did it. I just have to jot it down on paper." It was all in his head.
Yeah.
So.
No, I think it's a good comparison to this because it's hard as a human and not a heptapod. It's hard to imagine. You know, just looking at a really complex symbol and getting a really big idea. So one thing that's sort of similar, I guess, is, you know, I studied Japanese for a while when I was in college, and they have an alphabet, but then they also have a system called kanji, those mm-hmm. words, like one kind of complicated symbol that you just sort of have to memorize all of them. And so you see the one complicated symbol, and there are strokes within it that are related to other symbols and things like that. Like there's certain ways they're built, but you know, you just memorize basically the one symbol and its meaning, but it also comes with sound, so it's like a little bit different from this. It's hard to imagine, like especially in the movie when they draw the big circles,
right?
Like being able to look at this circle and like know what it says, like right. like a whole potentially really complicated thought, like right. they express.
But I mean, really, when just writing by itself, just regular writing like we see here, mm-hmm. is pretty miraculous when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I've seen, there was some movie about American Indians who used to talk about writing. It was the talking paper.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. somebody scribbled some things on it, some other person reproduced it exactly.
Right.
Which is pretty, like
yeah.
the lady in the TED Talk says, you know, it's pretty strange. I can make these sounds
mm-hmm.
and make air vibrate and transmit thoughts into your head.
Well, spoken language is common to, like, all human civilizations, but writing isn't. Writing isn't correct. Something everybody has.
So I found this quote about free will mm-hmm. and future. So here it goes. This was from the story. So similarly, knowledge of the future was incompatible with free will. What made it possible for me to exercise freedom of choice also made it impossible for me to know the future. Conversely, now that I know the future, I would never act contrary to that future, including telling others that what I know. Those who know the future don't talk about it. Those who have read the Book of Ages never admit to it.
So in the book, does she not tell Gary that the daughter's going to die?
I don't think so. But in the movie, they imply that she tells him, and that's why
why he leaves, yeah.
Right.
It's kind of shitty. In the movie, they imply she tells him that the daughter's going to die. And right. And he says she made the wrong choice. And I don't know if that's supposed to be the choice to tell him, or the choice to have the daughter in the first place,
right.
or what
right.
choice.
And so here he implies that this is not just because you know what's going to happen doesn't mean you can stop it or
right.
would stop it.
It's embracing fate, you know, it's sort of embracing
right,
the idea
right. so,
that there's...
So right, so this kind of goes back to the nature of time. So I in between reading the story, I've read the book by this physicist, Italian physicist, about, it's called The Order of Time,
mm-hmm.
which he tries to explain what time is.
Oh, God.
And I came away from it very confused. But the kind of the large point that he tries to make is that in physics, as far as we know, there is no such thing as time. It's just a dimension like length. You know, you, as far as all the formulas and our understanding how things work, you know, typically the example that they give, if you play some, if you make a movie or something, play it forward or backwards, we can tell the difference. But in physics, if you were able to film some experiments, if you play them forwards, backwards, you can't tell which one is forward, which one is backward. And that's how physics is mostly. There's just one thing, this thing called entropy, which is not, which is unidirectional, which kind of implies time. But he basically seems to imply time is really like a construction of human mind.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is the question, you know, this is what I said before about music. How can music exist, right? Because now exists, right? Now it's now, right now, bing, now. That other bing was in the past, it's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. Future hasn't happened yet, right? What is music? Music is sounds in time. So if I'm have first beat of a bar happens, then second, then third, by the time you get to the fourth beat of a bar, what happened to the first one? It's gone. It's gone. It doesn't exist.
No.
So I think what he says in the book about time is that it's like human memory kind of creates time, because, you know, the reason music exists because you kind of remember what happened a couple of seconds back, and that makes music. And so it's very weird when you...
So music does exist, is what I'm getting from this.
Well, apparently.
Somehow.
It managed to exist.
Yeah. No, I mean, absolutely. I think that's... and you should put a link or something to the book that you read.
Yeah, I'll put a link to that book. And so the other thing, and the quote I just read, she mentions Book of Ages, which is allusion to a story by José Luis Borges. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. He's written a bunch of stuff, these kind of weird stories, but one of them is called Library of Babel. And basically the story is about this library that's infinite. There's infinitely many books, and every possible book is in it, which means the library contains the story of your life.
Oh, yes, that's where the title comes
from. So that's kind of, I think, where the title comes from that idea. And, of course, the joke is that, you know, library also contains the book, the story of your life where your name is spelled differently, you know, for every other spelling.
It's like a library. It's like a multiverse library.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things we should... So we've talked about some major themes in your time, being an illusion, how language shapes reality, fate, that kind of stuff. I think most of those themes come forward from the, I guess, what would be the A plot, which would be the main plot about the heptapods.
Right.
So the question then is sort of like, what is with this secondary story about the daughter? Besides, you know, helping us understand what's happening to Louise. And I think for in both the book and the movie, what I got from it was... this theme of the questioning, like what is the purpose of life kind of thing, but also I think embracing the idea that a life is complete and whole no matter its length, that it's like valuable no matter how long it was.
Right.
Because to Louise, time is no longer... she's like the physics problems, right? Time is no longer really an issue.
Right. She knows it all.
Right.
I mean, she can see the whole thing.
Right. So she you know, her, and I think it speaks a lot to her character that whenever she talks about her daughter, she talks about her in the future. She does future tense, because she's not saying, you know, I remember back when you were alive before you died and this horrible thing happened. Right. She's saying, I remember a time when you...
But maybe the other purpose of that second story was to show what I just said is that, you know, your fate is set, and you cannot change it,
Definitely.
Or you shouldn't change it. See, this is another quote kind of along those lines, but the heptapods, the spoken language, which is like a linear, and the written language, and says, for heptapods, all language was performative. Instead of using language to inform, they used language to actualize. Sure, heptapods already knew what would be said in any conversation, but in order for the knowledge to be true, the conversation would have to take place. So this is the idea of a wedding. You know, Ezra knows what happens at a wedding, but until everybody says the right thing... The thing hasn't happened.
Right.
It's kind of strange. Yeah, I don't know why. I suppose he made the secondary story, or the other story, as a death of the child. just because it's very traumatic. That's kind of very, if you could change anything in your life.
Right, exactly. So, no, I think you're right. I think it goes towards those themes of fate. And I think it also sort of, the whole story sort of calls into question. And for humans, I think this could be very challenging. If you know what's going to happen already, what's the point? Right,
and then which is what it's like a play.
Right, know? But it sort of like takes the shock out of anything and takes the surprise out of anything. And I don't know. It's.
But again, it's like when you're performing a piece of music that was written by somebody else, right? Mm-hmm. It's all there.
Right, exactly. Why did we do that? I don't know. I wanted to talk about one other structure thing I just missed earlier. So I was talking about how the chapters sort of alternate between these two stories, and in the movie as well, the scenes cut between the two. But in both the movie and the book, they begin to bleed together. So towards the end, her chapters have both within a chapter. So like there's a chapter where she's with Gary, and towards the end, and she sees like a salad bowl. And within that chapter, then there's like a paragraph or two where she has the future memory of the daughter knocking the salad bowl over.
Right, that's right, yes.
And
yes.
So they start to bleed together, and I think it's just fabulous writing. And then the movie does that just by making the clips cut closer and closer.
Right.
And I think it's just fabulous writing what a genius way to structure a story, to have these sort of two plots slowly converging to get this point across that this is now how Luis is seeing and experiencing the world.
Right.
So I thought that was just super neat.
Talk about gender stuff, since you finally got your female character.
I did finally get my female character, and I'm mostly happy with it.
I liked it too, yeah.
I'm mostly happy with it. I am nitpicking. This is nitpicking. I understand that I'm nitpicking, but I'm going to nitpick because it's my favorite thing to do. Gender-wise, my only struggle is one thing you pointed out that I had noticed when I watched the movie originally, but I had forgotten, which is that you have all these scientists and stuff working on this, and the lead female character is a linguist, and the lead male character is a physicist. And there is that sort of... that's a little bit gendered in that.
Human physicist.
Right. Yeah. It's a little bit gendered in that the study of language and things like that are more, slightly more feminine coded than the study of, hardcore mathematics, which is nowadays, which is more masculine coded. So it's, a little bit stereotypical that the man would be the physicist and the woman would be the linguist. I don't think it's breaking. I don't think it hurts the story in particular. I think it could have been swapped and it would have been fine. But then, character would have been Gary, not Luis.
Right.
So, and then, but that sort of gets to my second issue, which is it's a little bit, and it toes the line, it's a little bit stereotypical for female character's whole story to be about either the man she loves or her children. And it's not that, women can't love their children or anything like that. They absolutely can, as can men. It's just when you're writing a story, you make these choices actively. And it's a little bit of a pigeonhole. Again, I don't think it's something that breaks the story. And I think it's very believable, especially considering the child dies. And whether you're a father or mother or whatever, any child that you care for that dies is a horrible, traumatic thing. So it's just it's one of those things where I noticed it because I was thinking about it. I don't think it really hurt much. But I also thought the story was fabulous. So I couldn't find a lot to complain about. So it's just I don't know. It's just something I'm aware of. I'm not sure. I haven't read a lot of Chang's other stuff. So I don't. Part of the question is that part of a pattern? Does he write like that? Or is that just this particular story?
Did you read The Tower of Babylon?
I did, but I don't remember that really having any gender stuff in there that I noticed.
I don't think so, yeah.
As because for example, when we read Ursula Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness, she seemed to have in that story actively put in the gender stereotypes for the purpose of exploring it, which is great. That's how you're supposed to use it, as opposed to sort of unconsciously having your stereotypes complete into your writing. So that was the only thing. I don't think it was bad. I don't actually have anything really to complain about much with the book. So you want to talk about favorite parts?
Yes. Yeah.
So let's start with the book, or the story. What was your favorite part in the story?
see, what did I put down?
I wrote time.
Well, structure. The time structure, the structure of the book, just kind of went between the two stories, kind of interleaved. You're right, I didn't notice it, but it became, you know, more interleaved as it got towards the end, which is very cool.
Yeah.
And like the non-zero sum game little piece, that was kind of cute.
Yeah, that was in both.
Yeah.
I think my favorite part of the story was the scene I talked about before in the when they were in the Chinese restaurant. And she sort of makes the connection with the ferment. Did I talk about it before? I talked to you about it before we started recording. She makes the connection between Fermat's principle, the light beam, and that the light needs to know the goal before it starts. And then she makes the connection to the language.
Right.
It was one of my favorite scenes. It's very well written.
I also like the bits of like philosophy that were kind of thrown in about, you know, free will versus knowing your future.
Yeah.
I just happened to listen to another physicist the other day on some podcast, and in physics there's something called complementary principle.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes up like when you talk about light, is light a particle or a wave? The answer is yes. And it's both. But depending on which experiment you perform, one or the other exhibits itself, but not both at the same time. So this is like another example of that, where you can have free will or you can know the future. But you cannot have both. Or they're like two different things, you know, or the complements of each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can either look at the world where I have free will and I don't know what my future is, or you can look at the world where there's free will, where I know the future, but there's no free will. Because
the future's already set. Okay. In the movie, I think we both put down the same favorite part was that we liked the reveal, the climax of the movie where she calls the general, and there's that the cut scenes back and forth. Because I thought that was very well done in comparison to the part of the movie I disliked, which was that they do this thing where the American soldiers that are working with them at their ship in the movie are like spooked by the aliens or something.
Xenophobia.
Xenophobia.
Immigrants.
Exactly. Yeah. Damn aliens coming here and taking our jobs. And they put a bomb inside the ship and one of the heptapods gets injured and dies. I didn't think it was a necessary component of the movie. And on my first watch through, I didn't get it. I didn't understand what had happened.
Right.
And then later I figured it out and I was like, I didn't think it was... The rest of the drama, the political drama, unfolded in and of itself, like, fine. But I must say... The bomb scene in the movie does give us a great moment between the heptapods and the humans, because Luis and Gary are in the ship when the bomb is, like, ticking. And the heptapods, of course, know about it. And the heptapods come up to the screen and are, like, they're, like, tapping on the screen with their tentacles.
Oh, right.
And the first time I watched it, I, like, had no idea. And then when we rewatched it, I was like, he's pointing. The heptapod was pointing at the bomb to try to warn them, which was cute.
Yeah.
It was nice of the heptapod.
Yeah, I didn't like that the movie had to go to this political kind of a thing. Which is kind of a standard kind of a thing for alien invasion movies.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what else they could have done, right, to have this
an exciting thing, yeah.
But
I mean it worked.
It worked all right. It didn't really take away from the rest of the movie.
You know what it was? It's like the rest of the movie was very unique, like super unique in terms of like science fiction. But the political drama was kind of generic, you know, because like you're saying, it's like when, you know, aliens arrive, what do? We all freak out like that. We've had a lot of movies like that before. And then both of us for the book couldn't think of something that was our least favorite part.
Right.
I really highly recommend this short story. It's not long.
Right. And even if you know the plot.
Yeah,
you can still enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly. So if now you're thinking about it, you should go read it. We should tell them what the gift was.
Oh.
Right? So the gift, and this is a little bit different between the story and the movie. The heptapods came to teach humans how to speak their language.
Right.
That was it. And in the movie, the heptapods explain that in like 3,000 years or something, they're going to need humans' help.
Right.
Something like that.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
One of the heptapods.
You know, linear humans couldn't quite get stuff, so.
Yeah, so the heptapods are like, you know, we gotta come here and teach you the language so that you can come help us in 300 years. Which, then it's weird because they know that, and So they're just playing it out. It's so bizarre. It's just so bizarre. But yeah, so Luis was right. You know, they weren't trying to give like a weapon or anything. They were just trying to do some like a really good foreign language lesson, basically.
But yeah, I really like the story because, you know, those two ideas of how language influences your thinking,
mm-hmm.
and the nature of time,
mm-hmm.
kind of pretty deep ideas.
Yeah. I wonder if anyone's done like an interview with Ted Chiang and asked him like how he came up with this. It's really creative. It's like deep, hardcore science fiction creative, you know?
Yeah.
And
it's also written very well. I mean, it's mm-hmm. very cleverly that you don't notice. Yeah. So the interesting part is that both movie and the story end in the same spot, which is the spot they begun mm-hmm. in, where she's with Gary, I guess, and which we find out at the end that's Gary,
mm-hmm.
and he says to her, you know, let's go make a baby.
Mm-hmm. So do you think? So I guess we both liked the story.
We both liked the story. Yes.
You think the movie adaptation.
I thought it was pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I thought that it did a really good job. It's hard because I really liked it, so I don't have a lot to complain about.
You know, if I had read the story first, I would not think that would be a good movie.
Why?
I don't know, because in story, it's more stuff that happens in your head.
Yeah.
You know,
the story's more, I guess, like cerebral in the sense that like it's more thought than action.
Right.
But I think that the movie does a good job of getting a lot of that thought on screen.
Right.
You know, and mostly by exploring the way that they do the experiments.
Right.
You know, the various... And there are some great scenes in there. Like, I love the scene in the movie where when they first go into the ship in the movie, they go in, like, these hazmat suits.
Right.
Because they, like, are scared of aliens, right? And they're in these hazmat suits, and Luis is trying to teach the aliens the word Luis, like, her name. And she's like, they're not getting it. And she's like, they can't see me. And so she just like tears off her hazmat suit. And everyone's like freaking out because she's being exposed and they don't know what's going on or whatever. And she like goes up to the screen. There's like, I'm not sure if it's that scene or later where she puts her hand on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's there. She puts her hand on it and then the haptopod puts its tentacle on it. So fabulous, fabulous visuals.
And the writing actually, come to think of it, the way they portrayed the writing in the movie was probably one of my favorite.
Yeah, I that's one of the things I prefer. I prefer in the movie that they've made the logograms circular.
Right.
Because it fits into that whole, like...
Right. No beginning, no end.
Time is an illusion, yeah. Nothing is linear. I don't know, I thought the movie adaptation was fantastic. I thought they did a really good job. And the main actress, whose name I do not know, but I recognize her, she's in lots of stuff. Okay, so that was
our impression of the story.
Yeah.
You should read it and go see the movie,
mm-hmm.
whatever order.
You could start the movie in the middle and it'll be fine. So next time we're going to undertake a large book that we've both read before, Speaker for the Dead by Orson Scott Card.
This is going back, you know, continuing with our theme of unusual aliens.
Yeah, definitely. And I read this, because I read Ender's Game,
mm-hmm.
Ender's Shadow, and then I read Speaker for the Dead. But I was, like, pretty young when I was reading them. How old was I when I read it?
I don't know.
We went on we took a family trip to, like, St. Croix or something when I was reading Ender's Game.
You're probably still just beginning of high school or something.
Yeah. Or, like middle school, yeah. So I remember the main plot of Speaker for the Dead, but I know I missed a lot. So it'll be good to have it on the reread. Now that's a thick book, so that's gonna...
Yeah, I'm gonna listen to the audio version. I've read it several times already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to rereading Speaker for the Dead. I love Ender's Game.
Mm.
I've not seen the Ender's Game movie.
You should watch it. It was pretty good, actually. That was another pretty decent adaptation.
Yeah. Speaker for the Dead is chronologically after Ender's Game,
yes.
Right? Okay. All right. Thank you for joining us for History in Reverse. We'll see you guys next time.
Bye. you know, okay, it's recording now, so we can make Easter eggs of all kinds. okay, I have to see, I took lots of notes.
Let me see. Oh, you put the date on it. That's so cute. I like the music analogy.
We have to talk about that, yeah. Because that seems to be...
gives like a really good, I guess, human understanding of it as best you can.